had kind of two choices. One could be dealing with policy issues with international infrastructure, like undersea cables, satellites, and domain name servers, and DNS servers, which would be more international infrastructure. We're dealing with national infrastructure and dealing with international policies in that arena, and that's the latter route is the one we went here. And we thought a good footing would be to begin with very well accepted principles, like from the Hague and Geneva Convention on, you know, the rules of laws of war. So we have a good starting point of what is widely accepted by civilization as some no-nos. And beginning with that, we began to render those principles. We read through article by article of applicable sections of these conventions and began to render what these principles would look like in cyberspace if you apply them. And that's what this report that we came out with is about. Its title is got a little bit of a long title, introduced as for context as a Russia-U.S. bilateral on critical infrastructure protection, working towards rules for governing cyber conflict by rendering the Geneva and Hague Conventions in cyberspace.
And essentially this takes somebody's working in the Red Cross in normal warfare, you cordon them off. You don't go after those folks. There are some rules of warfare, essentially. This applies that to the cyberspace.
Yeah, basically saying we're thinking this through. So, for example, I think you're referencing to perhaps something like in the Fourth Geneva Convention that deals with protection of civilian persons in the time of war, section, you know, part two, article 18 talks about, you know, hospitals should be marked by means of an emblem. They should be, situated far from military objectives so that they could, you know, not be exposed to collateral damage and things like this. And if you actually, you know, try to do that in cyberspace today, you know, it's not that, you know, straightforward. I mean, you didn't really have, you know, computers in 1949 when these articles were developed and agreed to. And we've, you know, fortunately with the great success of information and communications technology, we've had a lot of efficiencies and a lot of progress in many areas throughout society. But we have kind of lost the ability to protect some of these principles here because of the, you know, from the area that you bring up, there's intermingling between protected entities, personnel, assets, and stuff that are other assets and personnel and entities that would be legitimate targets. And also, for example, you know, you used to have hospitals and vehicles marked by, you know, Red Cross or Red Crescent, for example. There are no such markers in cyberspace. Yeah.
How do you even do that in the internet world?
Well, there is a proposal, you know, like we have .com and .gov that we're familiar with, that it's possible, you know, one thing we'll be exploring is if you had something like, you know, .net, you know, for example, or some other designation to indicate that a site or, you know, a message was an area that was solely dedicated and being monitored and confirmed as being for very specific humanitarian purposes that would be protected by these principles.
So talk about some of the recommendations that are in this report. And well, before you do that, talk about why is this so difficult to do? It seems like, of course, you know, Red Cross, medical purposes, humanitarian organizations trying to help people in those places. That would be something we want to cordon off. But it's one of those situations where easier said than done.
Sure, and there are lots of, you know, good reasons why this is difficult. You know, one of some of the areas we've already talked about, yeah, this intermingling and this tangling of protected entities and, you know, legitimate targets. You also don't have them marked and designated. We already covered that. You know, and it's so difficult given that you can derive from that difficult for someone who is you know, trying to target something to distinguish between a legitimate military and civilian target.
Well, that also seems to be one of the real challenges here is out in cyberspace, you don't necessarily need to be a nation state. It tends to be nation states have armies. That's not necessarily true out in the cyber world.
Exactly. You know, our report has five joint recommendations, but before that, as a foundation, we have ten joint observations that we felt were really critical and essential for those readers to understand how we arrived at the recommendations. And one of them is exactly what you're saying, is that, you know, now we have nation state actors and netizens, individuals wielding, you know, a much significant the elevated power in cyberspace. What they can do is, you know, have access to, you know, weapons. That there's a very low threshold for attaining these relative to other weapons that could have mass impact, and utilize them. And at the same time, you have simultaneously society becoming increasingly, I mean, profoundly dependent upon cyberspace for its basic operation. So you have increased exposure and increased access at the same time.
One of the interesting recommendations, well, they're all interesting, but one that particularly piqued my interest was what's titled Examination of a Third, and this is in quotes, Other Than War Mode. Essentially, there's no definition of what a cyber war is right now, and what you're recommending is that we need to define what this is.
Right. If you look at some major leaders who in our country and elsewhere around the world who've had responsibilities in this arena, and they've spoken, and we've had comments such as there is cyber war going on now, there is no cyber war going on now, and there will be in the future. It'll be, you know, a major concern. As we'll say, will most likely never happen. I mean, you see major points that are just really 180 degrees out of phase with what's happening. And so, you know, one of the legitimate reasons is maybe things are being defined differently. Also, you know, possibly maybe there is some other paradigm that better fits this. Maybe the simplicity of, you know, war and peace, and there's some other, stages of conflict before war we recognize, and there's things such as sabotage and crime and such that are in this discussion. But maybe we really need to take a step back and be open and free to think about other types of modes that are taking place that are really other than traditional definitions that we're familiar with.
So these recommendations, they're just out. What happens with them now? What happens with all this going forward?
Sure. Well, in the report, each of the recommendations is stated in a concise manner and also identifies what the required commitments are from Russia, from the United States, from other countries that might be interested in being involved, and suggests the next steps. So there'll be convening of experts and stakeholders to walk through specific steps for each of these to attain the objective of getting each recommendation implemented, and we're beginning immediately. We've already had calls since the release of the report at the Munich Security Conference just a week ago.
Very nice. Anything I didn't ask you about that I should have?
Oh, if you need to know anything about the East-West Institute.
Yeah, why don't you explain it, because not everyone will know what the East-West Institute is.
Sure. Let me just a couple points about the East-West Institute. It's a not-for-profit, nonpartisan organization. It's fiercely independent, and that's ensured by having a diverse international board of directors and supporters. It has offices in New York City, Moscow, and Brussels. And we like to think of the Institute as a think and do tank. It's really about addressing some of the most difficult problems in the world, using track two diplomacy to reframe issues and then mobilize resources to implement recommendations like the ones you see in this report.